Okay, so continuing this ongoing theme of we're separate or we're different, because I want to suggest we're separate, we're different, because we understand why. You know, some things in life are the consequences of our choices, aren't they? And some of the things we've looked at over the last few times I've spoken, things like health and money and so on, those things, whether we succeed or fail with them, are to some extent at least the consequence of our behaviour. Wise behaviour with money, typically you'll do well, eat the right diet and so on, generally speaking you'll enjoy better health. But what about that unknown quantity? Is it just about a roll of the dice? Is that all that makes the difference between people who succeed and people who do not? Well, part of the question I'm going to suggest to you is to do with what we call the great controversy. Now, this idea of there being a sort of an external goings-on between good and evil, which catches us in the middle, is not unique to Adventism. It's not unique to Christianity. Pretty much every religion or philosophy has some kind of an idea that outside of us, outside of our world, there is some sort of battle or struggle going on. But what we do have is a fairly unique perspective on it from the Bible, which starts off by reminding us that once upon a time there was war in heaven. And the war started there between good and evil, between God and Satan. But how that impacts us is a very interesting point. And it's asking this question of why, which gives us a sort of sense of control over things. Remember from the Matrix movies, the restaurant scene? When you actually analyse what the language is, it is a very, very cleverly crafted scene. It really is, with the French and all the rest of it. But the Merovingian says this. He says, why is the only real source of power? Without it, you're powerless. When you think about that, that's quite true. All sorts of different situations we find ourselves in would make no sense unless you understand why. I'll give you an example. Someone rushes at you, complete stranger, you've never met them before, start shoving their hands in your mouth and stabbing at you with sharp instruments. What are you going to do? You're going to fight to the death, aren't you? Unless you understand why, because they're a dentist. Make sense? So it's the understanding why. Why makes all sorts of things easier to bear. It makes all sorts of things come together in a way that we can sort of get our heads around them. Why? Understanding why. And of course that's the question we ask, isn't it? When things don't go quite the way we expect them to. When someone who's lived a healthy lifestyle gets sick, why? When someone who doesn't deserve to prospers, why? Okay. Well, we're going to go to the book of Job. It's one of my favourite books in the Bible, because although it does deal with some very high spiritual themes, it's also incredibly pragmatic, and it's the kind of experience that a lot of people have. And so, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount we can get out of it. It starts off very simply this: in the land of Uz, there lived a man named Job. Now we're going to split it into three sections. We're going to look at the background behind the story, we're going to look at God's purpose, and we're going to look at the idea at the end of restoration. But we start off with this part of the story. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. Job is a bit of an interesting book because we don't really know much about it. There's one tradition that says that the written record of Job is the oldest manuscript in the Bible. But then equally there's another tradition which says that Job was among the exiles who returned from Babylon. About the only real clue we have is that one of the bands of raiders who came in and stole all Job's worldly goods were the Chaldeans. Does anyone remember which city Abraham was told to leave? Of the Chaldeans. Okay. So it's a fairly weak link, but it's possible that the story of Job is set maybe slightly before the story of Abraham, in a time when a nation which is by then settled and building very prosperous cities is still back at the stage of cattle rustling. So maybe a couple of hundred years before Abraham's time, but you know, somewhere around about there. And that's interesting in itself, isn't it? Because the Bible tends to follow a very linear narrative. Here's Abraham, here's Isaac, here's Jacob. And it's fascinating to get these little insights that off that beaten track, there are also other groups of people who are true to God. Of course, you follow that single track down to our present day, we think about the remnant, we think about, oh, that's us and so on, but there are other groups of people who are true to God. But of course, the dating of the book of Job potentially gives us a bit of a problem, because we need to consider this scene in heaven and what it's actually all about. Because the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And Satan's response is, "Yeah, right. Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. It's interesting that this is not the only time that Satan does this business of sort of accusing people before God. We have also this story over here in Zechariah. Clearly it's a symbolic story. I don't think it's literally that Joshua is standing before an angel or something, but he says he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord and Satan standing at his right hand to accuse him. This sort of three-way thing, the good power, the evil power, and stuck in the middle as the subject of their debate is you and I. Okay? And the same sort of thing comes up again at the very end of the Bible story in Revelation, where in Revelation 12 verse 10, talking about that war in heaven, we'll come back to that thought in a moment, it says the accuser of our brothers and sisters who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. Okay. Now, this poses an interesting question for us, which is, how do we put these things on a timeline? For instance, is Satan still in heaven acting in this role of accuser? Or is he no longer able to access that? Well, yeah, it's not necessarily quite as simple an answer as you think. You see, in Revelation, it says this, the great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, and he goes off to make war on the church. Okay, so that's the way it's presented in Revelation. And the theory, which I must admit was always the theory I had fallen into and thought, yes, this makes the most sense, is that this war in heaven took place after Calvary. So Satan rebels against God. God puts up with him in heaven for 4,000 years plus. But once Satan has finally tried to kill God by getting Jesus lynched, God says, okay, look, you've overstepped the boundary in this war in heaven, and he's thrown out, and in a very linear chronological sense, he then begins to persecute the church. Well, the first observation I make is, in what way is the book of Revelation ever sequential or linear? Doesn't necessarily work, does it? But if that was what we're going to accept, so Satan's in heaven, and he can accuse people, and he can accuse Joshua, and he can accuse Job, but then we get to Calvary, and Satan's thrown out, then that accusing no longer happens. But when you actually start to look at some of the scriptures, you realise it's not that simple. For example, in Isaiah 14, the prophet says, "How have you fallen from heaven?" Notice the tense, past tense. "How have you fallen from heaven, morning star, son of the dawn? You've been cast down to the earth." Hundreds of years before Christ, Isaiah says the casting down of Satan happened, past tense. Okay, here's another verse that we looked at last week, but we didn't actually major on, Luke chapter 10. Jesus says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." And it's in the context of his disciples come back and they say, "Jesus, it's amazing, even the demons are subject to us in your name." And Jesus says, "Well, of course, because I've already thrown Satan out of heaven, I've already vanquished Satan. So is it any surprise that in my power you can now have power over demons?" And again, for this logical argument to produce this logical argument, the one has to come before the other. So clearly, Satan was thrown out of heaven long before the cross. And so one of the other suggestions that comes up is that, in fact, Satan was thrown out of heaven prior to creation. And that the statement in Revelation that he's furious and he goes off to make war against the children of God is a statement which is always true. And the first group of people he makes war against are Adam and Eve. Which poses an interesting situation for us. Because clearly, once this planet entered rebellion, Adam and Eve saying, "Yes, we'd rather believe Satan than believe God," Satan now has the right to claim this world as his. Which is why in the temptations he offered it back to Jesus. He said, "If you just bow down, I'll give it back to you." And he could say that because we're his. Which means that when the sons of God present themselves for monthly committee meetings in heaven, Satan has a bit of a sort of a legal right to be there as representative of this earth. And I think it's a little bit like Nigel Farage going to Brussels. They hate him. They can't stand him being there. He hates everything about that and he wants to destroy it. But legally, he's got the right to be there and they have to let him in. And I think it's a bit like that. Which brings us to the interesting conclusion that it's entirely possible Satan is still in heaven accusing as he did Joshua, saying, we can't let that person into heaven. Look how sinful they are. And God has to rebuke him and cover that person with the robe of Christ's righteousness. It's interesting, all the way back there in Zechariah, we get a very New Testament picture of salvation. But also Satan in heaven saying, you know, that follower of yours you think is so faithful. Let's see how faithful they are when they lose their job. So a lot of the things that happen in our lives might very well be a consequence of this three-way battle going on in heaven still, with Satan accusing, with Satan causing trouble, as it were, for us. So I would suggest that that is very much the background to explaining some of the things in our lives that might otherwise not make sense. There's a battle going on. We're in the middle of this battleground. Okay, so let's move on and have a think about purpose. One of the bits in the book of Job, which I've always found very, very difficult to cope with, is where, well, we know how the story goes. We know that Job suffers all this calamity and things go wrong and his family are killed and he loses his wealth and his health goes and his friends show up and they make life worse by saying, well, it must have been something you did. And he defends himself and they say, no, it must have been something you did. And he defends himself and 30 chapters later we're still at it. But Job begins to pose questions to God. And the questions he poses do not seem unreasonable. It's not disrespectful. But he does ask why. And you'd expect, wouldn't you, that God would give him the explanation which the book of Job in chapter 1 actually gives us as readers of it. But in fact, he doesn't. God's response to Job is, who is this who darkens counsels with words without knowledge? And he goes on to ask Job a series of questions which basically end up very much putting Job back in his box. Where were you when I this, that and the other? Who did such and such? Do you even know how such and such operates? Can you do this? And of course the answer to everything is no. And we wind up with Job having to say, I know that you can do all things and no purpose of yours can be thwarted. But it seems at face value like a terribly unsympathetic response, doesn't it? You know, if my boss did something which massively negatively affected my life, you know, like so I lost everything, and I went to him, and I'm not being unpleasant, and I'm not being confrontational, and I'm not asking him to change his mind, but I'm just saying, can you tell me why that had to be that way? And he says, how dare you come here asking me questions like that? I'm not staying around very long with that person as my boss. Because it's only a bit of decent human decency to say, well, look, you know, I'm sorry, but it had to be this way because of this. Or, you know, sales were down, or, you know, there was this situation or that situation, or I've got a different picture of the world to what you've got, and I had to act in this way, and so on. But God doesn't do that. God does the, how dare you come here and question me bit. And I think that needs some unpicking. But it does. Job's response in the end, in Job chapter 42, makes us think of something which I believe is very, very important. God acts who and what he is, not because of what we are. And I want to emphasise that with regard to prayer as well. We spoke a little bit about this last week. Yes, we're told to continue in prayer, to persist in prayer. But I think there's a real danger in thinking that if we pray just the right way, or we pray with the right mindset, we get enough people to pray, or whatever else, we can swing God's will. I repeat my statement, God acts or doesn't act because of who and what he is, rather than because of what we are or what we do. Okay, so with that statement of Job, I know that you can do all things and so on, let's go to the New Testament and find a couple of verses which will help us explain why God responded the way he did. John chapter 9 is the story of a man who was born blind. And as soon as the disciples encountered this man, they said, what's the cause? So they, in their mindset, it was simple cause and effect. Who sinned? They said, was it this man? They didn't think that through, did they? How can you sin before you're born? But anyway, right? Or was it his parents? Perhaps it's his parents' fault. They were terrible people, and so God punished them by giving them a son who would be a beggar all his life and unable to care for his parents in their old age. Okay, you'll notice the similarities between that and what Job's friends argued. Cause and effect. Well, it must have been something you did, Job. Must have been something. Must be some sin. But notice what Jesus' response was. He was born blind so that the acts of God might be revealed through what happens to him. In other words, it's not cause and effect. There's a higher purpose. Now, it poses one question to us, which is, do we really think God caused this man to be born blind just for this purpose? Well, I don't think so, and we'll see another verse in a second. What about the story of Lazarus? You see, we know the story. Lazarus gets sick. He gets sicker. The sisters send for Jesus. Jesus delays. He doesn't go until Lazarus is well and truly dead. And when the people come to Jesus and say, look, if only you'd been here, you could have saved him. Look at what Jesus' answer was. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Again, not just cause and effect. Again, there's a higher purpose to this thing. And of course, it also answers the question, do we really think that Jesus went and poisoned Lazarus' supper so that he would die? Well, no, of course not. He got sick. Had there been antibiotics in those days, he probably could have been healed by the local doctor. Probably. But when a thing happened, God used it for his glory. Notice those two things, so that the acts of God might be revealed, and so that the glory of God might be revealed. Do you see the parallel with what God says to Job? When Job says, why did this happen? God doesn't say, hey, let me explain it. God says, do you know how glorious I am? Do you know how powerful I am? And actually, that's the answer we need. He's telling Job, he's saying, what's happened to you happened so that the act of God might be revealed and the glory of God might be revealed. And that gives us a challenge, doesn't it? Because in our lives, when things go badly, it's not difficult to turn to God. And when things are then resolved, it's easy to see God's power. But what about when things go well? What about when we get our dream job? What about when we achieve that financial milestone? How often do we actually reveal God's glory? Or how often do we say, ah, at last, I've been recognised for all my hard work? Very human, isn't it? But our lives then, in this great controversy, should be lives of purpose. And our purpose should be to show the acts of God and the glory of God in our lives. So we move on to the third theme, which is that of restoration. The theme of restoration runs throughout the Bible, all the way from God's promise to Eve that one day a son would be born, and that son would crush the head of the serpent. All the way through to the very end in Revelation, where he says, behold, I make all things new. So let's look at some of these verses as we go on through. Isaiah, remember not the former things, nor consider the things of old. Why? Because there will be new things. Psalm 71, though you have made me see troubles, many and bitter, you will restore my life again. And the one I just alluded to in Revelation 21, which says, he who is seated on the throne said, behold, I'm making all things new. Beautiful verses. But you know, my favourite one is over here in Joel. God has sent judgment on Israel in the form of locusts, whether they're literal or symbolic. But at the end of that, he says, I will restore to you the years the locust has eaten. And when I read that, I think to myself, you know, that's true, isn't it? Probably every one of us has some part of our lives we think those are the years the locust ate. Whether it's years away from God, or years in a dead-end job, or years in some relationship that wasn't working out for us, and God says, I'll restore to you the years that the locust has eaten. Of course, in Job 42, we have this. The Lord restored what Job had lost after he prayed for his friends, and the Lord doubled all that belonged to Job. You know, what's fascinating about this is that after 42 chapters of back and forth, the whole thing is summarized in 5 verses. And they're not even very long verses. After the whole thing, the argument, the debate, the background, the is Job righteous, is he not, God speaking, Job speaking, all the rest of it, the whole thing is wrapped up in this restoration in 5 verses. And then the book ends. Because apparently no matter what Job has suffered, when God restores, none of it matters anymore. Now, you know perfectly well that if this was a modern book, it would go on for another 27 chapters talking about how Job struggled with PTSD and how he had terrible body image and how he became anorexic and how he needed counselling and, oh, woe is me, and the emotional side of things. And the story of Job just ends. God restored, and that's it. And the former things are remembered no more. So the Lord restored what Job had lost after he prayed for his friends, and the Lord doubled all that had belonged to Job. And that's an interesting point, actually. He doesn't turn Job into something he wasn't before. Job was previously a farmer, and he doesn't now become a king. He's still a farmer. It's just now he's a doubly prosperous farmer. He had 10 children. God doesn't give him 20 children, but he restores what Job had lost. The Lord blessed the second part of Job's life more than the first. And by the way, the second part of Job's life was 140 years. It's not a bad innings, is it? Not really. Now, in all the land could be found women who were as beautiful as Job's daughters. So even the children were extra special. God restores, and it's God's goal throughout the Bible story to restore. And of course, we look forward to the final restoration. But going back to this same famous chap from the film, he says, you see, there's only one constant, one universal. I can't do the French accent, so I won't try. It's the only real truth, causality, action, reaction, cause, and effect. Is that true for Christians? Or is there a bigger picture, or is there something else going on? You see, our lives, we often think of the factors that shape us the way we are. And one of those are the things I'm going to call baseline factors or background factors. You're born into a certain family, you're born with a certain amount of physical strength or physical beauty or whatever else, okay? And those things inevitably shape your life in some way. When we become adults, we further begin to shape our lives, hopefully, by engaging in wise behaviour. And so we become the people we are as adults. Along the line, as Christians, we'd also believe that God's discipline in our lives, either negative or positive, discipline works both ways. You notice that in the Bible, whenever there's a threat of discipline, there's also a promise of blessing. If you do this, you'll be blessed. If you do that, the opposite will happen. And so we normally think of these factors as being those that affect and shape our lives the way they are. But I want to suggest to you that there's actually a greater plan. That not everything in our life can be explained away. Not everything is a simple case of cause and effect. Nor is it a case of the dice falling that way. But rather, it's part of God's plan to display his glory and to display his works in our lives. I hope that's an encouraging thought. But on the other hand, it is a thought which sometimes takes away from us the semblance of control over the path of our own lives. And so I want to return again to this thought of restoration. You see, I feel sometimes that in focusing on the cross and putting crosses on the top of our churches and wearing crosses around our necks and so on, we've missed the point. Because if the story of Christ had finished on Friday evening, it would be of no more than academic interest. Oh, how nice. I've been forgiven. But I've still got to pay the bills, and I've still got to survive this illness, and I've still got to, you know, whatever else it is. It makes no odds. Oh, whoopee, you know, I've got a clean record book in heaven. My sins are forgotten. They're thrown in the depths of the sea. Now let's get on with real life. But when Christ came out of the grave, when he triumphed over death, he gave us that hope of restoration. There's a future, and it's a much more glorious future. And just like when Job was restored, and there's no more mention of what went before, when we reach that future, when we get to heaven, none of the stuff that's happened in this life will mean anything to us. But while we're still in this life, it is our responsibility to demonstrate the glory of God and to show his works in our lives.